have no idea, but we just saw it yesterday, and it is awesome.
Even if BillPetro.com doesn't say it's awesome.
It's awesome. Our objectives for this morning is that we did not finish our lesson last time because of the overwhelming discussion we had on the pros and cons of three different kinds of church leadership, which is episcopal, hierarchical, Archbishop of Canterbury, then bishops, then rectors, authority flowing down from above. The second was Presbyterianism, which is what we do, where the congregation elects men who represent them, and then they rule. The third one is congregational, where authority comes from the members of the church, kind of a democratic form of church government. We talked about the pros and cons, and we discussed that for a long time until someone in the back of the room asked the question, well, what does the Bible have to say about church leadership? That'll be the first thing we talk about. Secondly, we'll describe the growth of religion in America. You should be able to examine the difference between pilgrims and Puritans. You hear those two terms, what's the difference? And then we'll begin to discuss the distinctives of American Puritanism in contrast to English Puritanism. So, what does the Bible have to say on this subject? Glad you asked. There are three words in the New Testament that talk about different roles in the church. One is the presiding people, the other is the serving people. The first word is elder, presbyteros, which translated into English is elder, and it represents the idea of men who are older, wiser. But there's another word. By the way, you see this in Acts 14 and 15. Paul appointed elders, especially during his time in Ephesus. There's an extended period in Acts 14 where he lays hands on them and blesses them. And then in Acts 15, when Paul and Barnabas come to Jerusalem, they meet with the apostles and the elders. There's another word, which is episkopos, translated overseer. That's literally what the word means. Epi is over, and skopos is to see or to look. And we typically translate the word now as bishop. You can hear it in the Greek word episkopos. This appears in Acts 20, verse 28, but it also appears when Paul writes to Titus, and he talks about the qualifications of elders and overseers. In Titus 1, 5, he talks about elders, and he says, Titus, my disciple, you're on the island of Cyprus. I sent you there to appoint elders by the laying on of hands. And he starts going through the requirements of an elder. But then in verse 7, in the same breath, he uses the word episkopos. So these two words, overseer and elder, are used interchangeably in the New Testament. And they, while they're not synonymous, the idea of overseer talks more about the function of the leader, to be a shepherd. These words are used interchangeably, and they're used in plurality. It was a group of leaders who had their authority because of their plurality. The apostles laid their hands on them, and then after the time of the apostles, the elders would lay their hands on the new elders, just like we do in our church. There's another word that's used in the New Testament, shows up in the book of Acts chapter 6, and that's diakonos. We translate this as deacon, but the word means a minister or a servant or a table waiter, because that's in fact what they did. The Greek-speaking widows were not being attended to and being fed. So the apostles said, we cannot divide our attention by by doing that, we will continue teaching and praying. Why don't you, the church, elect a group of men? And it's interesting, all their names are Greek because they're going to attend to Greek widows. And their job is to wait tables. Now, it turns out they were pretty knowledgeable. Stephen and Philip, two of these deacons, were very powerful in terms of the word and in their preaching. So, elder overseer in the New Testament, they were the presiding officers after the death of the apostles. And then deacons, they served or they were assistants to the elder overseer. Well, how does that progress throughout history? Glad you ask. So for the first 100 years of the church, you see this plurality of leaders, the elder bishop, elder episkopos, until about 100 AD. And then Ignatius, who lives in the eastern part of the empire, starts talking about not a plurality of leaders, but a single leader, which is a bishop or an overseer, and below that are elders who are referred to as priests, and then they're deacons as well. Cyprian, who lived in the 3rd century, he lived in Carthage, which is the northern part of Africa, talked about the idea of a federation of bishops, that all these bishops who were in charge of churches all over the empire, each of them had equal authority and they would meet together and he would pull together councils and they would decide on issues of heresy and practice. Now, Constantine confirmed that. We've talked about Constantine. He was in Hippo of Africa. But remember, around 325, you have Constantine, the first Christian emperor, calling the Council of Nicaea. And one of the things that happened during that period of time is Constantine took Christianity, which was an illegal religion. It had been persecuted by the Emperor Decius and Diocletian, and tons of Christians were persecuted and killed. He said, no, Christianity is a legal religion. And that made Christianity not have to suffer under persecution. Theodosius I, who is the succeeding emperor, made Christianity the state religion in the capital of the empire, which back then was Constantinople, modern-day Istanbul. Now, what do you think happens when Christianity becomes the state religion? There are good parts and there are bad parts. One of the bad parts is that, well, it really would help your political career if you were a Christian, no matter how Christian you are. Maybe you just use the name, maybe you're just a nominal Christian. At the same time, because the state recognizes Christianity as the religion, there's a tendency of state government to influence church government. And so you see the rise of bishops up until the late 400s. Leo I, he was the first bishop of Rome to be called the Great. He's Leo the Great. He met Attila the Hun as he was getting ready to attack Rome and talked him out of invading Rome. Pretty significant. There was also a controversy as to who is Jesus? Is Jesus God in man? Is he God with man? Is he a man that took on the spirit of Christ? Is he Christ who looks like a man, but not really? And so people had been debating this for years, and there was a council called at Chalcedon, and Leo wrote a letter called the Tome of Leo, and he said, and I've told you this one before, but let me give it to you in full. Jesus is truly man and truly God, one person in two natures, divine and human, united in that one person without confusion or mixture, without change or division forever. And everyone said, that's it. That's the missing equation that we've been looking for years. And that became the teaching of the Council of Chalcedon, and Christianity was clarified during that time. Let's zoom out again. After Leo, there was Gregory the First. He was called the Great. And he was a Roman senator's son. He himself had been a prefect of Rome, powerful in the government, but he led a monastic life thereafter. He set up a monastery on his parents' property, and he was called upon to be the Bishop of Rome. With his monastic background, he brought a lot of deep spirituality, but he also was a talented administrator because he had been part of the Roman government. And this was the beginning of a single bishop over all of the churches. Now, the word pope appears around here, but the establishment of a papal authority in Rome dates from the time of Gregory the First. A singular bishop over all of the churches in Christendom. With me so far? It was said that if you wanted true orthodoxy, you went to the Bishop of Rome. And so it was. So the philosophy here is that in post-apostolic times, the idea of authority in the church passed from God to Christ. Christ selected apostles, and there were successors under the apostles. The biblical idea is that the apostles laid hands on elders, overseers, and that authority passed on through history. Let us jump forward now to where we are in the 1600s and talk about church government from an interconnection between church and state to complete separation of church and state. So in England, the Anglican Church, the Church of England, was the state church. You were born in England, you become a member, you're baptized into the Anglican Church, you're a member of the Church of England. Lutheran Church in some countries in Europe, same thing. Presbyterianism, not quite as tightly tied to the state church, except in Scotland. Congregational, you're starting to move away from a state church where each of the churches are independent and have a democratic form of government. And then you get to the Baptists and the Anabaptists who say complete separation of church and state. We don't want to have a state church. With me so far? Moving pretty fast. Charles II. Remember, there was a time of civil war in England. Charles I dismissed the parliament until he needed to raise taxes to fight the Scots. So he called them back, and there was a conflict. There was a war between Charles I and the largely Puritan parliament. The war ensued. Things did not go well. Charles I was condemned of treason, and his head was removed ceremoniously from his neck, the first time a king of England was executed. So we have a long parliament, during which time several things happen. Oliver Cromwell comes to power as the military leader of the parliamentary army, and he's a very devout Puritan. At the same time, Parliament decides we have to figure out what it means to be the Church of England. And they call together an assembly at Westminster called, ironically, the Westminster Assembly. And the Westminster Assembly gave us the Westminster Standards, including the Westminster Confession of Faith, which we've talked about already. The people wanted a king back, kind of like the Jews say, we want a king. So they brought Charles II back. Doesn't he look like his cousin, Louis XIV of France, the long flowing wig? The restoration of the monarchy, Episcopalianism returned. So there had been a debate between the Congregational and the Presbyterian and the Episcopal. He threw out the Westminster standards and said, we're going to have an Episcopal form of government. I will be appointing the Archbishop of Canterbury and various bishops. He was brought back under the promise that he would be kind to the Puritans. He said, yes, I will, and no, he didn't. There was a lot of persecution of Puritans who were called nonconformist. They did not agree with an Episcopal form of government. And there was a huge persecution of Puritans during this time. And for several years, the Puritans said, we want no king, we want no bishop. And several of them left for the savage lands of North America. But before we get there, let me talk to you about Charles II's brother, James II. Now, if Charles II was a closet Roman Catholic, James II was completely devoted to Catholicism. And he converts to Catholicism rather early, and he was forced to abdicate. Parliament just didn't like him at all. They suspected him of being pro-French when there was a war with the French. He was overtly pro-Catholic. He was forced to flee from England. Parliament claimed that he abdicated. This is the end of the Stuart dynasty. The Reformation is going in the wrong direction in England. This is the time of John Bunyan, Pilgrim's Progress. So, a summary. We have the Tudors here, Henry VIII and his children, none of whom had children themselves, replaced by cousins, James I, James VI of Scotland, who became James I of England, his son Charles I, the Long Parliament, when there is no king, the restoration of the crown, the Stuarts are restored. And it is during the time from James I and Charles I that people are leaving England and going to America, where they hope to be able to worship in their own way. Now, James II had a daughter. Her name was Mary. And she married William III, who was her cousin. He is the nephew of James II. And he was the ruler of the Dutch, the House of Orange. And so Parliament said, well, we've had a hard time with the Tudors and the Stuarts. Why don't you come on over and be our king? And he did. So he marries Mary II, and he establishes religious toleration for those nonconformist Protestants, the Puritans. Yay! The Glorious Revolution. All right, so here's a summary. Is England reformed? Well, we've got Henry VII and VIII, who were Henry VII is a good Roman Catholic. Henry VIII was Catholic, but not Roman. He broke from Rome because of some marital difficulties. His son, Edward VI, very Protestant. He had an Archbishop of Canterbury who was Protestant. One of his tutors was John Knox, very Protestant. When he died, his half-sister Mary came to power. Her mother was Catherine, the first wife of Henry VIII. She was very Catholic, and so was Mary. Persecuted lots of Protestant leaders. When she died, her half-sister, Elizabeth I, had to come up with a compromise to satisfy both the Roman Catholics in England and the Protestant. She came up with the middle way, the Via Media, which is the High Church of England has Roman Catholic practices, bells and smells, vestments, genuflections, kneelings, crossings. The Low Church was a watered-down form of Calvinism. When she died, that's the end of the Tudors. You get James I. Lots of high expectations for him. He's from Scotland, a Protestant country. Didn't work out that way. He was very Episcopalian. And when he died, his son, Charles I, was even more Roman Catholic. He had married a Catholic wife. Okay, and so then you get Cromwell, very Puritan, Charles II, closet Catholic, his brother James II, converted to Catholicism. William III of Holland, yay, very tolerant. So England is looking a little heavier on the Roman Catholic side, despite the fact that there's a Reformation there. All right, we're going to leave Europe, but first let me summarize everything we've been talking about since the fall. Martin Luther in Wittenberg nailed the 95 Theses to the Wittenberg door, and historians say that is the coat hanger for the Reformation. At the same time, in Zurich, Switzerland, Ulrich Zwingli broke from Rome and came up with a form of Protestantism, which we call today Reform tradition. In Geneva, Switzerland, where they speak French, not German, 26 years later, John Calvin developed his form of Protestantism, and the combination of the German Swiss and the French Swiss was called Reformed theology. Calvinism went to Edinburgh, Scotland, because John Knox studied in Geneva under Calvin. And so you get that Calvinistic theology up in Scotland. And chronologically, in Dort in the 1600s, early 1600s, you have a debate between the Arminians and the Calvinists that result in the canons of Dort, the 5 points of Calvinism. All of this is by way of review. During the time of Elizabeth, these Protestants who had fled to Europe to avoid the persecutions under Mary, now they're returning under Elizabeth, and they're called Puritans because they want a more pure form of worship than what they're seeing in the Church of England. They come back from Geneva, from Zurich, from Strasbourg, and from Frankfurt. And they bring with them the idea for a pure form of Protestant worship. Under the rule of James I, there's a group of Protestants who live in Nottinghamshire, in kind of the Midlands of England, and they decide, we just don't get along with the Church of England, we're leaving. They're later called Pilgrims. They are separatist Calvinists, and they go to Leiden, Holland. Holland is more tolerant, and they would fit in better. But after a generation, they find out that Holland is a little too tolerant, and their children are forgetting how to speak English. And so they say, you know, we've heard that there's this place called New England, new and improved, we're going to go there. So they get on a boat and they go to Plymouth, England in Cornwall, and they get on a boat called the Mayflower. And as that great theologian Neil Diamond said, they're coming to America. All right, American church history is divided into three parts, divided by two great wars, the War of Independence, the Revolutionary War, and the American Civil War, where more Americans died in that war than in any war before or since. Do you know why? They were all Americans. So both sides are counted. 620,000 people died. That's the size of Boston, population of Boston. All right, so we're going to be spending most of our time on colonial America. There's also the national period once we finish the war and the writing of the American Constitution, which pulled all of the colonies together. And that is debated, by the way, in this movie, A Great Awakening. It starts at the conference where they're debating what they're going to do with the Constitution. The worldview of the colonial period is Calvinistic. These are Puritans who've come from England or previously from Europe. During the national period, the worldview is Arminian because it's more individualistic. And in the modern period, since the Civil War, more liberal, more subjective, more existentialism. So you could describe it as theocentricism. It's all about what God is doing in our lives. Anthropocentrism, which means man-centered. It's all about how I respond to God. And then after the Civil War, more liberalism. This is this is Mayflower 2. It is a copy of the original Mayflower. This was not a passenger ship. This was a merchant ship. But they loaded up 102 people on this ship. And this is docked at Plymouth in America, in Massachusetts. The Scrooby Separatists, who came from Nottinghamshire, left England, went to Holland, left Holland, came very briefly back to Plymouth, England, and then to America. They went from Plymouth, England to Plymouth Rock. Interesting coordination there. 102 passengers, one died on the way and another was born. His name was Europa. That's what they decided to name this child. And they established the Plymouth Colony, which was the first permanent New England settlement. There had been other European settlements. Jamestown down in Virginia, for example, had a pretty rocky existence. But Plymouth was the first permanent one in New England. But they needed to put together the Mayflower Compact because their charter expected them to land in the Hudson River Valley, and they didn't land there. Hudson River Valley was part of Virginia back then. This is where they landed. They actually landed at Provincetown and then ultimately went to Plymouth. This is where they were supposed to go. New York, the Hudson River Valley. So they did not have a crown contract, and they were afraid that some of the people on the boat, not all the people on the Mayflower were devout Christians. Some of them were just looking for a better economic opportunity in America. So they sat down and they wrote a rule by the majority compact. That's called the Mayflower Compact. And the men signed this. And as you probably know, they stepped off the boat at Plymouth Rock. And what was neat is that the date was already on the rock, 1620. And they thought, this is a sign from God. This is kind of funny, this rock, you can see that it's cracked and it's been patched by concrete. They used to bring it out and put it on a cart and do parades with it during Thanksgiving, but it fell off the cart and broke in half. And it was, so they don't do that anymore. It's right there in the water, so you can see it. And we all know that it was a really rough winter, but the governor, William Bradford, called for a day of Thanksgiving in 1621, the following year. Half the population died that winter. So there are half as many men. And you see pictures with a few Indians, you know, when you talk about Thanksgiving, there were three times as many Indians as there were English men. But I can't talk to you more about that, but you could read more about it at the history of Thanksgiving at BillPetra.com. That's the Pilgrims, but the Puritans came 9 or 10 years later. They were non-separating Congregationalists. That means they weren't separating from the Church of England. They thought it was the true church. They did not hold to either Episcopal or Presbyterian forms of government, but congregational forms of government. And their churches ultimately became known as congregational churches. So if you see congregational churches, that's their history. Rather than settling in Plymouth, which is in the Bay of Cape Cod, they settled in Boston or Salem. Each of their congregations was independent, it was separate, and they believed the Church of England was the true church. They merely moved to America, where they could worship their own way. They believed that membership in the church was not based on being born into the church, but that each member repent of their sins, confess that Jesus Christ is their Lord and Savior. Ooh, novel idea. They hoped that England might imitate New England. In fact, they hoped the whole world would imitate New England. And this was the period of the Great Migration that lasted about 14 years. 21,000 people came from England to settle in Massachusetts. There were 50 pilgrims after the first winter, 21,000. Now, why did they come? We've talked about this in the past. Elizabeth had to deal with the Marian exiles who returned from Europe. James I was not sympathetic. Charles I married a Catholic bride. Ugh. Catholic lords in England were given important posts. The Archbishop of Canterbury was secretly, he was very Arminian in his theology, lots of Roman practices that we talked about liturgically, vestments, kneeling for communion, etc. John Winthrop came over on the first boat. There were 700 on the first boat. And he was a merchant and had a fleet of ships, which is one of the reasons why there were so many that came initially. Founder of Boston, governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And while he was on the ship, before they landed, he preached a sermon called A Model of Christian Charity. And in that sermon, he used the illusion of a city on a hill. Where have you heard that before? No, but it is in the Bible. Yes, Jesus talks about it when he says, don't hide your light under a bushel, you're a city on the hill. Everyone will see this. And this has become part of American civil religion, and various presidents throughout recent history have alluded to this, that America is a city on a hill. This is the seal of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, Nova Anglia, New England, and the Native American is saying, come over and help us. Where have you heard that before? Acts chapter 16. He has a vision where the Macedonians, and what's interesting, if you look at a map of Greece, there are three fingers representing Macedonia that stick out into the ocean. Come over and help us. And so Paul does go over to Europe. The English were not the only settlers in America. By the 1650s, a number of European countries had settled. Let's start with the French. The French way up in the north, you'll notice parts of Nova Scotia, what we now call Maine, and down the St. Lawrence River to Montreal and Quebec is where the French settled. Notice they did not settle Prince Edward Island because that's the home of Anne of Green Gables. The English settled the Massachusetts Bay at Cape Cod to parts north from there, but also south and west. They settled what is now Rhode Island, Connecticut. Connecticut has a river that goes north into Massachusetts, the Connecticut River Valley. But they also settled in what's modern-day Maryland around the Chesapeake Bay, both sides, the east and west shores, and Virginia, the northern parts of Virginia, Jamestown, etc. The Dutch settled along the Hudson River Valley in an area called New Amsterdam. What else are you going to call the land? Name it after where you came from. And there was a city down at the mouth called New Amsterdam. It's now known as Manhattan. The Swedes settled in Delaware, this Delaware area. The Spanish, remember Ponce de Leon, who was looking for the Fountain of Youth, they found it in Florida, and they named it Disney World. Some contrast between Pilgrims and Puritans. Very few of the Pilgrims survived. There were many Puritans. Pilgrims came about a decade earlier than the Puritans. Pilgrims were working class or poor class. Some of them were so destitute, they were happy to get on a boat and come to America where there were greater economic opportunities. Puritans tended to be upper middle class, more educated. The Pilgrims wanted to separate from the state church. Puritans were still loyal to the Church of England. The Pilgrims settled in Plymouth. You can go there today. They have an interpretive center. One of the things that was fun is I asked some of the actors, what Bible do you read? And they said, well, we don't know how to read. They were illiterate, or they were posing as illiterate people, and they were not part of the religious Pilgrims. Puritans in Boston and Salem. Some of the names, if you're a Pilgrim, your name is William Bradford or William Brewster. If you're a Puritan, your name is John Endicott or John Winthrop. So the Bills and the Johns pretty much separated those two groups. Let me disabuse you of some of the myths around the Puritans. There's a saying that said Puritans had this haunting fear that someone somewhere might be happy, and that needs to be stamped out. Puritans loved books. They loved music, beer, rum. They drank more rum than we do today. They would swim. They would skate. They would bowl, but not on the Sabbath. They all wore black, right? No, they loved blue and violet and green and yellow. The women's dresses were beautiful. But they were very narrow-minded. No, they went to Oxford and Cambridge. Of the first group that came over, 700, over 100 of them were educated at Oxford and Cambridge. Well, they were dumb dogs, meaning they weren't really educated and they didn't speak much. After 6 years in America, they established Harvard. Whoa! There was a guy named John Harvard who dedicated his library. He gave his library. He's a single Puritan man, and they started Harvard to train men for the work of the ministry. Women were sheltered, though. You know, it's a patriarchal society, and they were literate. They were well-read. They managed not only their household, but single men and women. Where did they live? They live with a family. Who governs them? The wife did. They were songless. No, they sang a cappella in unison, just like we do. They were really a minority of the Americans. No, by 1776, 75% of Americans had Puritan roots. Doesn't mean they were Puritan, but their fathers, their grandfathers were Puritans. Ben Franklin's father was a Puritan. Didn't work on him so much, but they would develop something called the New England Primer, which, how do you teach children? They have pictures and letters. A, in Adam's fall, we sinned all. B, thy life to mend, this book, the Bible, attend. The cat doth play and later slay the mouse. A dog will bite a thief at night. So these primers would teach you the alphabet and morality. Almost 100 years later, Ben Franklin was still printing this in America. By the age of 5 or 6, you could read and write either from private school or homeschooling. You go to Latin school or grammar school for about 7 years, where you'd learn Latin, Greek, and Hebrew. Wouldn't that be amazing? Most people don't learn Greek and Hebrew unless they go to seminary. I learned it in college, and I was a weirdo. But you would learn it in grammar school. Then there was college, which lasted 3 years. And then you could go on to seminary, which lasted another 3 years, where you could learn ancient history. Now, the study of history today, in elementary school, you're taught a basic understanding of history and how the world works. In high school, it's explained, no, it's quite a bit more complicated than that. Everything is more complicated than what you learned in elementary school. You go to college, everything you know is wrong. But if you watch the History Channel, you find out that history is all about aliens. One word summary. Henry VIII was married a lot of times, and that caused him to change the religion of England based on the decision of the monarch that affected all the people. His children kept switching it back, Catholic, Protestant. Very different from the continent, where it started with religious people and affected the government. Cromwell gave us the Commonwealth, no king. The Pilgrims were separatists from the Church of England. The Puritans intended to establish as saints a city on a hill to influence the rest of the world. That's it. Any questions before we close?